You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Welcome to episode 290, and in this one, I interviewed Dr. Stephen Phillipson. Stephen is a licensed clinical psychologist, and he's been on the show many times before, so I'm sure you're familiar with his work. But in this one, we discuss two of the most common spike themes of OCD, which are what if this never goes away, and how do I know this is OCD and not an authentic concern? He normalizes the process of OCD and the emotions that fuel it, the mistakes some people make in their recovery mindset, when OCD pops up in your mind when you wake. We discuss the idea of irrelevance, the recovery mindset. He shares plenty of examples and illustrations and much more. So really interesting topic. I think this has got something for everyone in it. So I hope it helps. And thanks always to NoCD for supporting the show. I deeply appreciate it. If you want to find out more about NoCD and their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories or click the link in the episode description. And as always, thank you to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here's Dr. Stephen Phillipson.
Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Always a pleasure to be here, Stu.
Yeah, it's good to have you on again. So today we're going to talk about a couple themes or worries. You know, one is, how do I know this is even OCD? And another one is, you know, will this ever go away, or what happens if it never goes away and I'll be stuck worrying about this forever? So anything you want to share on those initially?
Sure thing. I'd like to start actually with the second one that you've mentioned to kind of get the ball rolling. The condition of OCD is a very disturbing experience to go through, and oftentimes it's a very disturbing content thematically. Just to kind of remind all of our listeners that without the malfunctioning experience of OCD, without the intense distress signal, or as all my patients call it, the authentic crisis, because OCD obviously produces an experience of alarm that is 100% authentic to any actual crisis that any person might be going through. I say it's kind of like if a cobra snake is about to bite you, that's as real as OCD matches these themes with that experience. Yeah. So the desire for this condition to go away obviously is immense, and the seeking of relief from the condition is understandably very, very high. Also, just kind of reiterate at this point the idea that the only difference between a person's brain with OCD and a person's brain who does not have OCD is this distress signal. People place so much emphasis with OCD on the content of the thoughts as if they're the problem. And, you know, in fact, research shows clearly that persons who don't have OCD pervasively experience the exact same mental associations as in the themes of people with OCD. The only difference is the emotional component. So people make two very common errors in their recovery mindset. Number one, they want the thoughts to stop. And that's a mistake, because why would one want one's own brain to function in a way that's not natural to the human brain? It's very natural to all human brains to conjure up these associations that are often one might describe as dark or inappropriate. But also, you know, it's just important that we remember in managing OCD to never really judge the theme of our brain's creativity. But, you know, to get back to the idea that looking for the thoughts to go away as a measure of the finish line or success is a mistake and inappropriate. Now, the goal really of OCD treatment is to bring the brain back into its natural state of functioning, which means that there is not going to be this profound alarm system going off, because that's really the foundation and nature of the condition, that people with anxiety experience this anxiety in a very pervasive and very disturbing and distracting way. So that's a really important component to focus on in terms of this number one topic, where's the finish line, and will this OCD last forever? When patients ask, you know, when can I expect to have relief, that suggests naturally and understandably that there's a focus on reaching the finish line. And what's really important is that in a OCD treatment mindset, that looking for relief is actually counterintuitive to the actual therapeutic agenda. The entire basis of treatment for any anxiety disorder, particularly OCD, is the conveyance of irrelevance, the ability for the human to show his or her own brain that the activity, the malfunctioning activity of the brain, is irrelevant, meaningless, inconsequential. And when the brain is responded to in that way, its natural tendency is to start healing itself. Looking for relief or even ritualizing to find an escape is tantamount to kind of peeling off a scab on a wound. You really don't let the body heal itself when you do that. It actually reopens the wound and re-stimulates bleeding. And that's, you know, kind of how relief seeking acts on the brain, which really is not invested in producing these signals. People often look at their brain in its malfunctioning as it's as sort of an adversarial, tormenting enemy. And it's really important to understand that OCD is it's a warning signal that's gone awry, that's malfunctioning and misfiring, and it's creating an emotional warning of a crisis where there is no crisis. What's interesting is, you know, people focus on relief and the termination of their brain's malfunctioning in a way places a focus on not having the challenges. It's interesting because if I said to a patient, I have this crystal ball that perfectly predicts your future, and I can see that exactly 1 year from today, your brain will stop malfunctioning, I would guarantee that the vast majority of people in receiving that information, if they believed it, would probably have their symptomology discontinue after about 2 to 4 weeks. Because there's such an emphasis on when am I going to get better? When is this going to go away? That it actually creates an in-the-moment distress and resentment when the brain sends a signal that reminds the person, hey, I'm still here. You haven't gotten relief yet. So also keeping in mind that relief seeking is not only the focus on, waking up one day and not being reminded of OCD's presence, but it also involves a lot of ritualizing with the desperation, the idea that if I sufficiently ritualize, if I come up with answers, if I find closure on the topic, that this will go away. And obviously, we're very, very clear at this point and confident that you cannot shut down OCD through ritualizing. It's interesting because many patients indicate that when they wake up, the first thing that occurs to them is their OCD theme reactivates and reminds the person that the condition is still here. And that often sets off a very demoralized reaction to, oh boy, another day of suffering, another day of being tormented. In a recovery mindset where one is allowing the brain to heal itself, the the person, the patient, would wake up, their brain would prompt them about the topic, and they would say, okay, another day where I have an opportunity to demonstrate to my brain that this continued prompt is meaningless and irrelevant. And so a patient who's in a recovery mindset actually looks at challenges as an opportunity to demonstrate irrelevance rather than a reminder that the condition is still present. When one looks at someone who has a fear of flying, what you often hear from a person with fear of flying is as soon as the plane takes off, they start looking for when the plane is going to land. So they look at their distress during the flight as something that they try to achieve a sense of being tolerable by the reminder that it's going to come to an end. And that focus on the end as if that is the goal, once again, it really sustains the idea that being challenged is the problem. And so one of the ways that we can convey irrelevance to the persistent brain activity is to be able to look at where you are in the moment. And if you're engaged in a recovery mindset and a recovery life path, one would notice that you're engaged in your life process in a way that has not been altered by the presence of anxiety. And so to achieve relief in the idea about the persistence of the brain's challenges, by focusing on the idea of what I refer to as the unaltered life path, to be able to say, yes, I am experiencing these associations. Yes, I am experiencing this emotional distress, but look at me. The choices that I've actually made as the gatekeeper have put me exactly where I would be with or without the challenges. And in my mind, the conveyance of irrelevance has no greater mechanism of demonstration than to be able to say, whether I'm challenged or whether I'm not challenged, my life path remains completely unaltered on both sides of the fence. And when a person achieves that degree of acceptance, to be able to say, hey, brain, it doesn't matter whether you challenge me or not, because I'm able to live my life completely as I've designed it, rather than being manipulated by relief seeking or avoidance of things that might provoke the thought. That is the profound demonstration and allows for incredible healing. So on the note of when will this ever go away, for now at least, those are some of the critical ideas. A patient, can really be distressed because not seeing the finish line, it's kind of like managing COVID. I remember in May of 2020, in New York being shut down, the world being shut down, and them saying, oh, we need to flatten the curve. And I remember when the curve got flat around May and then June, they said, oh, no, it's not flattening the curve that we need to look for. It's that it not continued to spread. And I realized that the government wasn't offering a finish line. And I thought how profoundly demoralizing that's going to be to the population to be able to say, when will normalcy be returned? Because they keep moving the finish line. And I think that created tremendous emotional distress to the world and society at large. And the same thing has to be said about persons who suffer from OCD, is that the absence of a finish line is a profound demoralizer for a person to be able to avoid the secondary features of OCD, which are depression. And depression is often a byproduct of a person feeling victimized and tormented and not seeing any potential to find an escape. And I think that's one of the most tremendously emotionally disturbing aspects of OCD, is it doesn't provide any definitive finish line, nor can the therapist provide a definitive finish line. Although I can say to patients that if you adhere to the therapeutic guidelines, if you're very compliant to the exposure, the aggressive exposure paradigm, and very compliant not only to exposure, but the mindset of irrelevance and the elimination of the resentment, for the brain being so persistent, then it can really hasten the production of the therapeutic goal. One of the analogies that I often use with patients is I talk about two people who are starting a company and they're going to make any product. And so in business, the concept of the any product is called a widget. And focusing on one of two things, per partner A focuses on how much money is in the bank account, which is the analogy to symptom relief. And partner B focuses on the quality of the widgets that are being produced with the idea and faith that if we make really good widgets, the profit's going to show up as a secondary dividend of focusing on the process. And so OCD treatment is almost exactly like that. Whereas many, many people engage in the therapy, but they keep checking their bank account to see whether or not they're still being challenged or how much they're being challenged. And they become very demoralized because they think, hey, I'm doing the therapy. Why am I still being challenged like this? Whereas the skilled patient is businessman B, who focuses on the quality of the widget or who focuses on the quality of their adherence to the treatment process. One of my patients in the Tuesday group said something that I think was one of the most profoundly brilliant things a patient has ever said about exactly this topic. And when we were talking in the Tuesday group about the finish line, he said, the finish line is the right now, in the moment awareness that you're engaged in the therapy in a skillful way. If right now you can check the box, I'm doing the things that the therapy requires to find recovery, and my mindset is one of acceptance and the conveyance of irrelevance rather than resentment, then you've achieved the finish line because the brain will then heal itself, but on its own time. So there were two things in my life that I experienced something similar with as a parallel. I've never had a day of OCD, although some of my patients claim that I must be lying about that because I understand the condition so well, they seem to say. But I can tell you that I'm not lying about that. But I've had two things in my life that have been very persistent and undesired. And one of those has been gastric reflux. And one of those was a sciatic pain in my right leg. I've only had gastric reflux once. It took me 7 months while suffering from the condition to figure out that it wasn't going to go away on its own and that I needed to kind of reformat my relationship with this gastric reflux. And so here I am coughing with patients, coughing up vomit, having cramps in my stomach, and engaging in a lot of burping. And, you know, the funny thing about my gastric reflux was that it would start on Tuesday mornings and it would completely go away Friday afternoon. And that just happens to be my work week. So when patients were telling me to take medication, I would say, no, I don't think this is a medical problem. I think this is very stress related because I don't think the body has the same calendar as my work week. So for it to start on Tuesdays and end on Fridays, it suggests to me that I was mismanaging some stress in my practice. So after 7 months of suffering from this gastric reflux, I decided to apply the exact same principles as I offer patients in managing OCD, that being the conveyance of irrelevance, the lack of resentment for my body malfunctioning, particularly in front of patients, and giving my mind permission to kind of heal itself rather than me desperately looking for relief. And much to my shock, it took 8 months after I started managing my gastric reflux in a very, very effective way for my brain to kind of get the hint that its production of these symptoms was not really a necessary part of my life. I mean, the good news is during those 8 months, it was a very kind of scalloped decrease, meaning some days would be more intense than others. I would notice like 10 minutes would go by and I wouldn't have any symptoms. And rather than being like, hooray, it seems like it's going away, I would say to my brain, hey, you know what? Whether the symptoms are here or not, it doesn't make any difference because I wouldn't be doing anything differently anyway. And so as my reflux decreased in its severity, my acceptance of its presence maintained very, very persistent. And then I remember after it sort of had gone away, when I would start talking to patients about this mechanism of recovery, I would start burping. And my brain would be like, oh, well, maybe I can come back. And my response to those burps would be, okay, be here or not, it's equally irrelevant. So there is tremendous parallels in the treatment of OCD, and also that permission giving of not having a finish line, not needing to see a finish line, but knowing that you're engaged in the therapy in a skilled way. For morale, that's very, very important. And I'm happy to say that the last time I actually had any symptoms of reflux was about 15 years ago. I've maintained that welcome to have it come back, and it hasn't. And my sciatic was sort of very similar, only my sciatic would kind of flare up, which is a very stress-related condition of cramping in my right leg. I would once again give my mind permission to send me these symptoms. And generally after about 2 to 4 months, the symptoms would go away. And, you know, I would experience relief. The funny thing about my sciatic is it's come back 4 times. But, you know, right now it's been away probably for a year. But once again, in saying that, I welcome its reemergence. And I just would say, hey, whether you're here or not, life's going to be lived the same. So those are sort of the main points in regard to the never-ending nature or the never-ending fear regarding people's relationship with OCD. Yeah. So before we go to the next topic, did you have any questions or comments regarding that?
Yeah, I think the bit at the end that around your sort of physical ailments,
I would call them stress related symptomology.
Okay.
I wouldn't call them physical ailments because that might suggest that medicine is the appropriate treatment.
Yeah. Good point. You've got that air of acceptance or irrelevance, whichever term we can use, of, well, if it comes up, it comes up. It doesn't necessarily change anything. I'm still heading towards where I want to be heading or doing what I want to be doing. Which I think, yeah, thinking about OCD, A, that's a powerful perspective to have. But B, obviously, when people start to make progress and then it suddenly hits them, oh, shit, I'm actually making progress here. Then that fear comes in of, well, what happens if suddenly the spike comes back? And then that obviously is an indication it will come back because you're egging it on now. You're bringing it back.
Let me interrupt for a second if I can, because that statement, what if the spike comes back, shows right away, if a person said that to me, which I do hear quite a bit, that the person hasn't understood the nature of the therapy. Because spikes returning is just the brain acting like a human. But a spike returning paired with the emotional distress can be, you know, alarming. It can be unsettling. It certainly is uncomfortable. But once again, it's really important that a person engages in the discipline to be able to say, hey, whether you're here or not here, whether I'm facing challenges emotionally or not facing challenges emotionally, I'm going to live my life the same. Now, patients will argue with me. They'll say, well, you know, it isn't the same, Steve, because number one, when it's here, I feel uncomfortable versus not feeling comfortable. So there's a difference. And number two, it can really impact my performance. It can have a deleterious effect on concentration. And therefore, in real world, our life is somewhat impaired by it. And to both of those, I couldn't agree more. You know, yes, uncomfortable or comfortable. But, you know, to me, life isn't a matter of like it being rainbows and roses. So it is natural for all humans to go through periods of discomfort. And it's really important that we accept that that is an unavoidable part of living as a human. Mm-hmm. And number two, that, yes, our concentration is distracted. You know, we can't really control that. You know, when I've had reflux or even occasionally if I have a panic attack, I'm clearly aware that my mental faculties are diminished to some degree. Mm. And that's an independent system and I've got no control over it. All I can say is I'm going to take cookie crumbs from the cookie jar and live on those, whatever little parts of me are still available, and not look desperately to reacquire that greater level of functioning that I'm capable of. So in that regard, you know, we just have to kind of make space for that variability and allow for these actual kind of detrimental symptoms to exist without struggling with them or being desperate to reacquire who we are as a person. So I'm sorry for interrupting you, Steve.
No, it's absolutely fine. Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have any more questions on that. No, not at the minute. Let's go on to the next one. So what happens if it's not OCD?
Well, I don't think the question is what happens if it's not OCD. I have more of a question that patients ask, which is maybe this isn't actually OCD. So, you know, the most common spike theme that I get with that question is people who have HOCD, people who are afraid that they may be gay. Number two, most common spike theme is, people who have ROCD, people who have questions about whether they're in the right relationship or not. And then the big one that everyone thinks is the worst spike theme, although in my opinion, every spike theme is the worst spike theme, which is the pedophile spike theme. What if I'm capable of or interested in being sexually attracted to or sexually engaged with children? So in this note, it's interesting because unfortunately, I think the greatest amount of wasted time in therapy is certainly around this question. How can I be sure that I'm dealing with OCD and not an authentic crisis in my life? Unfortunately, the answer is you can't. And, you know, OCD is a condition, as I've said many times, is predicated on the emotional component. The bad news is that this emotional malfunctioning component absolutely has zero ability to respond to words or cognitions. So we can't speak mostly to the amygdala, although there are a variety of systems involved physiologically in the malfunctioning of the brain. But the amygdala is a very basic part of the lower brain stem that's sole responsibility is to prepare us for an emergency. So if you and I as cavemen walk into a cave and in this perfect darkness, we hear a twig snap, we don't know whether that's a bear about to attack us or maybe it's a delicious deer and we're about to eat well. But our whole body is going to respond physiologically to prepare us for that classic term, the fight or flight response. And so with that in mind, we can't speak to that part of the brain and say, oh, we're very confident it's just a little bunny rabbit. We can only manage that signal through the conveyance of irrelevance. We can't put out that emotional fire by me spending hours and hours and hours convincing the person, you know, this is OCD and not an actual crisis. It's funny because many patients who come in to see me for the first time who have spike themes related to harm OCD or pedophile OCD or many forms of what I refer to as character indictments, themes where it sort of makes them look like a bad person, which is a very, very common, also kind of universal theme, you know, thoughts about doing harm, thoughts about inappropriate thoughts. That conveys this idea that their character is now being diminished. So many patients come in for the first appointment and they're terrified that I'm going to say to them, oh, wow, you clearly don't have OCD. You actually are an X, right? A violent person, a sex offender. And so, patients, I can tell you my entire career, not once have I said to a patient, oh, yeah, I don't think this is OCD. You actually have, you know, this actual problem in your life. Nor do I think it's ever going to occur in my career because people reach out to me typically after they've done a tremendous amount of research. And logically speaking, they've come to a pretty strong piece of confidence that they're dealing exactly with the condition because the factors that exist under the umbrella of the condition are so exactly identical to what they're going through. But once again, they can't lock in the answer, the conclusion that this is OCD and not something that they should actually be concerned about. Because as I hear patients say over and over and over again, and it a bit drives me crazy, they say it feels so real. It feels so authentic. And there's no one who is more aware, who has greater faith than the authenticity that these feelings that people are having are 100% authentic and no different, once again, to being, you know, about to be bitten by a cobra snake. Because there's no way for a person to differentiate a anxiety malfunctioning signal and an anxiety authentic signal, because the signal is exactly the same as it would be if you were were about to do something very, very dangerous. So saying something like, well, you know, silly, a pedophile looks forward to molesting children. They're not terrified of the idea that they might want to do it. So that sounds very reasonable and very logical. And it sounds like any intelligent person would be like, of course, I'm not a pedophile. The idea of molesting children is terrifying to me. I hear many patients say, I'd rather kill myself than ever be a risk to a child. That's not how pedophiles speak. But unfortunately, all this great wisdom has zero impact. And even if a person gets 10 minutes of relief because they see the logic of it and their conviction through that logic locks in a sense of confidence, the amygdala is going to malfunction again. The amygdala is going to send them the emotional distress signal. And once again, it's going to feel like they're in terrible, authentic danger, that they may be a harm to a child or harm to other people, or that their spike fee might be authentic. So once again, the topic for this theme, in terms of recovery, is not to speak about these topics as if we can ever convince someone that their theme is irrelevant, but they have to be the ones to demonstrate that their theme is irrelevant. And so it's really important that people not give in to that emotional impulse.
Yeah.
I always tell patients, talking to OCD is like talking to a two-year-old having a tantrum. Two-year-olds, want that candy, and they think if they scream loud enough that mom and dad are going to give it to them. So saying, hey, Johnny, you can have candy after supper. You just have to be a little bit patient, probably isn't going to produce much of an impact. But when we show Johnny that no matter how loudly he tantrums, there's not going to be an effective response to him getting his way, that can have much more of a biochemical change mechanism. And one of the things that I always tell parents, and I would tell, an OCD sufferer, is when Johnny's in the middle of a tantrum, you can say to him, hey, scream louder. I can't really hear you that well. So that message conveys irrelevance, and Johnny will often be very disoriented by that message. And even saying to the brain, hey, maybe I'm getting a little tingle seeing that same-sex person in my groin. Hey, you know what, brain? Give me a full orgasm. That would really be great right now. So taking the slight hints about there being a problem and voluntarily bringing up, I call it turning up the volume, can be a very, very powerful mechanism that demonstrates irrelevance rather than, seeking relief through reassurance. So I just want to reiterate that, patients with OCD tend to be very intelligent. They tend to be very rational, very logical. And so therapists can easily be seduced into thinking, well, since this is such an intelligent, rational person, let me just actually explain to them why this is OCD and why they're at actual zero risk of catching AIDS from a doorknob or zero risk from being harmed to other people. Unfortunately, that is completely not going to have any lasting impact. In the world of managing OCD, I tell patients, you're dealing with a condition where there are absolutely no answers. So engaging in any answer seeking under the umbrella, the thematic umbrella of OCD, is never going to produce any long-lasting therapeutic benefit. But it's so amazing because no matter how many times I tell patients that, the instinct to find relief through information gathering is just a very difficult one to kind of put out, because you know, a patient is about to be bitten by a snake, they want to hear definitively that snake's not poisonous, you're not going to die. And unfortunately, no matter how desperate a person is to get that reassurance, it just really feeds, as you're aware, the condition. Reassurance seeking actually exacerbates OCD, and it gives a signal to the medical brain, the biochemical brain, there must be a real crisis happening. Look how much effort and energy you're putting into escaping it. If there weren't a crisis, you wouldn't be exerting all of this effort to find relief. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, there's that really terrible paradox that the most basic human instinct for survival, giving into the most basic and compelling human instinct we have as an organism, unfortunately exacerbates the condition. And so treatment obviously requires tremendous emotional discipline. You know, to override the most basic compelling instinct we have as humans and not give in to that desperate desire to seek relief and to make sure beyond the rash, you know, any doubt that the nature of the threats are completely irrelevant. Yeah. So on that note, did you have any questions or input?
Yeah, not on this specific worry, but like going back to the previous one of, you know, will this ever end? Something that just came to me is around, you know, you said, you know, if your example, your personal example, it took 8 months or whatever it was to kind of your brain to relearn. And in the case of OCD, let's say it's 8 months. Obviously, it's going to massively depend and fluctuate depending on person. But let's just say it's 8 months. When you get those moments, the clouds part, even momentarily, you feel that sense of relief. And maybe, okay, I'm getting it now. I'm feeling better. This makes sense. I guess it just comes back to your picking the scab example of as soon as that anxiety kicks back in, but what if, et cetera, all these other worries, it's too easy to pick that scab, do the compulsions, whatever it is that just undoes. And I guess you're not starting back at week one, but you are delaying that 8 month, if it is 8 months, 8 month process, you know? I don't know why that just came to me and I just wanted to share it.
Yeah, no, that is correct. You know, a person engaging in desperate ritualizing, going online, asking people for reassurance. Unfortunately, that resets the brain's healing capacity because, you know, the brain is designed, the body and brain are designed to be self-healing in many, many aspects of life, but sort of when left alone. One of my most common parallels is really with sleep. And it's interesting. One of my future articles will be entitled Sleep, the Hostage of Anxiety, because sleep requires that we give our brain the opportunity and environment where it activates itself. We don't choose sleep. We set the stage for sleep, and then the brain puts us to sleep. But the more that we pressure the brain, or even if we ask ourselves every minute, am I asleep yet? That distances us from the goal of falling asleep. And anxiety and sleep are almost exact parallels in that regard. People engage in all kinds of mechanisms because of their desperation to get sleep. And, you know, they take medication that unfortunately puts them to sleep, but it turns off REM sleep so that they wake up as if they, you know, have a hangover and they wake up more tired than when they went to sleep in the first place. They change their mattress. They change their pillow. They do nothing in bed other than sleep. To me, all of these are attempts at sort of tricking the brain. But really, there's no trick. It's just a matter of dialing back desperation and just saying, you know, as I say when I'm challenged to go to sleep, I just say, hey, you know what? My goal laying in bed right now isn't to get to sleep. It's just to relax and to be in a comfy, cozy environment. If sleep visits me, great. If it doesn't, okay, I guess I'll lose another night's sleep. And tomorrow might be a bit more challenging, but I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt, and, you know, it's survivable. So my entire focus in terms of sleep is the dialing back of desperation. And it's sort of the same thing in terms of managing OCD, because a way of distancing yourself from the finish line of OCD is to make sure that you're not desperate to achieve that finish line. And desperation and resentment are mechanisms within our perspective in approaching and managing OCD that can push us back from allowing very wonderful ERP techniques to take their natural effect of producing habituation.
Yeah, it's kind of the term sort of getting out our own way is kind of what comes to me. And that almost feels a bit harsh saying that, but it's like just allowing our body and our mind to do what it was built to do, and not interfering with that process. And then on across both of them, we've talked a lot about irrelevance, and that's obviously come up before in past episodes. I guess initially, the idea of showing one's brain irrelevance or even dialing it up and showing it irrelevance that way is a more extreme version of irrelevance. Extreme is not the right word, but I guess some people are going to be like, that's too much. I can't even imagine showing my brain irrelevance because the thought is so scary, you know, of being this bad person. Or so how do you work with someone who's really resistant to irrelevance?
I mean, the answer that I have is not a very sophisticated one. I would call it time and persistence. Really, you know, turning it over to the patient to finding it within themselves to finally get on board with the recovery path, which is both a behavioral path, I'm very happy to say, as a behavioral scientist, but it's also a perspective path. And that's a little bit where some of the cognitive work comes in. And just to reiterate, you know, it's not cognitive work as in pointing out the irrational nature of the themes, because that would never have any impact on a thinkingless amygdala. It's really the cognitive part in managing one's perspective, desperation, and a bit sort of an immunity. You know, I live in a world where there are no such things as good or bad people. You know, if we believe in people being good or bad, the brain is going to continuously scrutinize within our own world whether we qualify to being a good or bad person. And I can assure you that the human brain is designed to place a lot more weight and bias on our deficiencies and moments of weakness. And therefore, people who believe in good or bad people are most likely to suffer a sense of inadequacy because their brain is just naturally designed to focus on their deficiencies. I always, you know, use the analogy, you know, why would our brain do that? Why would our brain be conditioned to focus on our deficiencies? And I can only guess, I'm not a PhD in anthropology, but my guess is when, once again, we were cavemen, if you were really good at picking up cave chicks and not so good at spearing the deer, I think your brain would say, you know, sure, you can find a cave chick, but you're not going to be able to feed your family, so you better get better at throwing that spear, rather than, aren't you a great guy for picking up cave chicks? And if I'm a really good spear thrower, but I'm not really that effective at picking up cave chicks, my brain would be like, yeah, you can feed yourself fat, but you're going to not have any offspring or mate to kind of hang out with, so your life's going to suck. And so I do think that there is a survival mechanism to the brain being conditioned to place much more weight on our deficiencies, you know, rather than our assets. And, you know, people with OCD are certainly not immune to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because evolutionary speaking, it would be our deficiencies that would get us killed. It's our weaknesses.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the funny thing about your example, it's the spear thrower is probably the one that would have got the cave chicks, because it's the spear thrower that was able to feed, and therefore that's it, evolutionary sexy, I guess.
Perhaps that would be the case, but you're getting a little bit too technical for me. I wanted to circle back on the spike theme.
Okay,
interesting is that, just to, it's sort of an interesting demonstration about how meaningless the actual themes are. I worked with this one patient who had four different spike themes. They never co-occurred, but his brain, like a roulette wheel, every week or every month would switch to the next theme. So his four spike themes were, number one, that he might have run someone over when he was a new driver. And 15 years later, his brain still hadn't come to a conclusion whether he ran someone over. And he always felt like working on figuring that out. Number two was that when he would be on a balcony, his brain would tell him to jump. Number three, he had thoughts that he might have cheated on his wife. And number four, he had thoughts that he might at work yell out racially inappropriate comments. And when his brain would be on, let's say, the jump off the balcony topic, the other three topics were completely irrelevant to him. If his brain even reminded him, maybe you ran over that kid when you were 17, he'd be like, yeah, whatever, I don't think so. Because there was no energy in the other three topics, he would respond like any other non-OCD sufferer to those topics. And then a month later, his brain would light up the, you're going to yell out racially inappropriate things. And he then wouldn't care about, you know, cheating on his wife. He wouldn't care about jumping off balconies. And he wouldn't care about running over a person when he was 17. And he would beg his brain to go on to the other topics, you know, rather than being tormented by the one he had, even though a month ago, it was the other topic his brain was focused on, and he couldn't wait for that topic to come to an end. So it really just speaks to the idea that focusing on the topics in any way is a complete waste of time, because this condition is just an energy that seeks out a face. And that's what OCD is. It's the broken amygdala. The neocortex, the thinking brain, can't handle feeling like I'm in a crisis for no reason whatsoever. So it artificially links these very random, often associations of these themes to the emotional distress energy. And most of the time, OCD themes are completely unrelated to any element of a person's character or nature as a human being in any which way. There are some exceptions, like I've discussed, I think, in prior episodes, where certain OCD themes have some tendencies towards some personality styles, but that's a whole different presentation. I think I already gave that one. Mm.
Yeah, no, it's a really good description. Yeah, I always think it's the same beast. It's just different masks.
Yes, right.
And today, this mask isn't going to scare you, so let's put on this one. And it's the fuel. You remove the fuel, you're not going to care if you have those thoughts. You know,
that's right. Yeah, and it's interesting because in the groups that I run, almost every patient in the group says, I wish I had that theme. Yeah. That would be easy to manage. The one that I have is the worst. And so that's a very, very pervasive kind of, you know, sense about the uniqueness of one's own suffering. When actually I tell patients, you know, I've worked with people who their entire OCD spike theme is a song stuck in their head. It doesn't even matter what the song is. You know, versus someone who might think that they're a pedophile, not one is worse than the other to the actual sufferer. It might seem to a layperson that, oh, poor person, he thinks he's a pedophile. What a horrible thing to think. But the actual sufferer's internal experience is equal suffering from, oh my God, I can't get this song out of my head. And he would say, well, I wish I had pedophile OCD because all I need to do is avoid being around children and life would be a bowl of cherries, when obviously it sort of just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
I just wanted to add it just to while you were speaking. What does treatment success look like? I was talking to someone earlier today, and this person asked me, can you cure OCD? You know, is the finish line a cure? And I'm asked this question quite a bit, and I like the perspective that I share, and that is that OCD in its treatment, success is like a volcano that goes dormant. There's still a volcano. It's still capable of erupting. Some volcanoes go 100 years without erupting. Some volcanoes erupt every 6 months. The idea that it's capable of erupting is like the amygdala still has this tendency to potentially start to malfunction again and be thrown off by some biochemical imbalances. Life stressors can certainly produce that. But to say, you know, I've had patients reach out to me 3-4 years after, you know, what I would call a successful treatment, where they, you know, achieve their treatment goals of in no way being handicapped by the condition. And they say, oh, it's kind of come back. And that's very much not uncommon. And we call that booster sessions. They usually last four times, reconstitute the exact same principles that got them into recovery in the first place. And the good news is most often their brain reacts in a similar way, and it doesn't take nearly the same amount of time to recreate that dormant state. So we don't use the word cure. We use the word remission. I use the word dormancy. And it's just like my sciatic, which has come back four times. I would say I haven't cured my sciatic. I would say that it's currently dormant for a year. And if it comes back tomorrow, it comes back tomorrow. If it comes back 10 years from now, that's up to my brain. It's not my department. And that's, to me, one of the most dismissive mechanisms that I have in regarding sleep, regarding gastric reflux, regarding sciatic, regarding any OCD. This isn't your department. You have no conscious control over these independent mechanisms. Therefore, best thing to do is to say, hey, brain, I'm going to let you make these decisions about your presence or absence, and I'm not going to meddle in it, and I'm certainly not going to try to control it. Because as I said in my choice article, trying to control independent systems does nothing but muck it up.
Yeah, I like that. Good way to end. Now, it's been a useful topic. I think both of these concerns, worries, obsessions we've talked about today, I've heard many, many times over the years. I probably had them myself. I definitely have. So I think it's going to be helpful for a lot of people. So thank you for sharing.
I hope so.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.